Critics of large-scale mergers and acquisitions in healthcare argue that when clinical assets are aggregated within contiguous geographic areas, there's market consolidation, which leads to anti-competitive behaviors. But delivery system leaders may view asset aggregation in a different way, as a vehicle for efficient deployment of human, physical, and financial capital to achieve a healthcare mission. I'm Stephen Morrissey, Managing Editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and I'm talking with Stephen Lipstein, former Chief Executive Officer of BJC Healthcare. Mr. Lipstein has written a perspective article about healthcare leaders' motivations and the benefits of consolidation as part of the journal's series on the corporatization of U.S. healthcare. Mr. Lipstein, from a healthcare system leader's perspective, what are the financial benefits associated with expansion?
There are numerous benefits associated with upsizing an organization through the means of mergers and consolidations. Some have to do with spreading the fixed costs of operating a health system, such as finance and revenue cycle management or information technology, human resources administration, legal services, supply chain. Think of it as all of the non-clinical aspects of administering a healthcare system can be spread over a much larger base of patient care activity so that it enables organizations to realize the economies of scale.
And then what about the benefits for research, medical education, or patient care?
So giving some real life examples, which I do in the perspective piece, when I was the chief executive of BJC Healthcare, we were able to position a National Institutes of Health designated comprehensive cancer center at the hub of a regional network of cancer centers where we were able to provide chemotherapy services and radiation therapy services in a distributed fashion closer to where people live, where they work, where they go to school, and making that cancer program much more efficient for research purposes because there was a single tumor registry, shared clinical protocols, access to highly specialized care without creating a large centralized bureaucracy.
What policies or market forces encourage mergers and acquisitions among hospitals and physician practices in the United States?
Well, Steve, there's a lot of history behind how we got to where we are today. Sometimes you'll hear people refer to our health system as an accidental health system, that it happened by accident, any one individual or one organization. And while that's true, we didn't get here quite by accident. So a little history is important. Back in the 1980s, our federal government adopted a prospective payment system for the Medicare program. And that prospective payment system was based on units of service, which we call diagnosis-related groups for inpatient activity, or ambulatory procedure groups for outpatient activity, or what we call CPT codes. Those units of service became the basis by which hospitals and doctors and clinicians got paid. And that was the advent of fee-for-service medicine. About 10 years later, in the 1990s, we realized that paying hospitals and doctors on a fee-for-service basis actually created an incentive to do more activity, to do more clinical work. And John Weinberg with the Dartmouth Atlas and other researchers began to uncover in the 1990s that there was a lot of utilization of healthcare services that were either unnecessary or didn't add value to the clinical outcome. And that spawned policies in the United States having to do with evidence-based medicine and clinical protocols and clinical guidelines. And the healthcare sector reacted fairly negatively to that, thinking that that was kind of overly prescriptive for the federal government to involve itself in developing those kinds of guidelines and those kinds of protocols that would dictate how medicine was practiced. And so the next evolution that happened right around 2000 and the decade that would follow had to do with the advent of managed care, where hospitals and doctors would be paid a global rate or a fixed payment that was based on a per capita amount for each patient. And that's really when the policies in our country started to create an incentive for hospitals and doctors to join together to get bigger. The idea was that if you were going to assume financial risk for a defined patient population, the bigger that population and the more diverse that population, old people, young people, healthy people, sick people, the better positioned you would be to absorb that risk and to disperse that risk over a large base of patient care activity and premium revenue. And so the incentive to get big happened about that time. And so it was around the turn of the century when hospitals started to join together to form large healthcare delivery systems. They began to acquire groups of physicians in order to take capitated risk for a defined patient population. And so it was those kinds of policies that really stimulated this large-scale combination of hospitals and doctors that you're seeing across the United States now.
Looking at healthcare systems that serve a disproportionate share of low-income patients, what are the challenges there and how have they contributed to incentives for corporatization?
Well, I think what we've seen across the country is that, at least in the hospital community, is that there are hospitals that are haves and hospitals that are have-nots. And those hospitals with a high concentration of publicly insured patients, Medicare and Medicaid, or the uninsured, increasingly have negative operating margins, whereas the hospitals that serve primarily commercially insured patients have a positive operating margin. So when you join together, as we did in BJC Healthcare, a system of hospitals, some of whom disproportionately serve publicly insured patients and some who disproportionately serve privately insured patients, you can use the positive operating margins of some hospitals to offset the losses or the negative margins at other hospitals. And that became a kind of formula for a health system, a regional health system such as BJC Healthcare, to continue to be able to serve patients in all geography, and in this case, of the St. Louis metropolitan area. So if one were to Google or call up BJC Healthcare on a search engine, you would see that they have hospitals and clinical facilities north of the city, south of the city, east of the city, and west of the city. And that geographic dispersion allows them to support the healthcare needs of an entire region.
You say in your perspective article that the importance of cultivating managerial bandwidth and subject matter competencies unique to healthcare is often underappreciated. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Today in American healthcare, the rules, the regulations, the environment has just become quite complicated. And so it's really important for healthcare organizations to be able to expand their subject matter competencies and expertise in a number of managerial areas that are very specific to healthcare, involving healthcare regulation, payer contracting, the rules that govern payment of hospitals and doctors. There are a number of quality programs, and in each geography, there are new and expanded roles for providers. So being able to recruit a talented base of leaders who understand the nuances of American healthcare is increasingly important. It becomes very difficult for small hospitals, standalone hospitals, and smaller organizations to recruit that kind of talent on a national scale.
What policy changes could support the positive aspects of corporate ownership and business models in healthcare, and at the same time mitigate concerns about their potential negative effects?
I think we're at a time of evolution in American healthcare where technology and changes that are taking place in our society overall make it necessary for us to think about how can we really improve the health of Americans. And it's impossible to separate the health status of Americans from the human condition. And the human condition in our country is affected not only by the healthcare system, but it's affected by many other factors, including the social determinants of health, lifestyle behaviors, and the way we go about accessing healthcare. Steve, when I think about it, we're now able to purchase groceries from home. We can purchase almost anything from home. During the pandemic, we were able to test ourselves from home. So increasingly, we have to figure out a way to reinvent primary care and move that primary care platform away from institutional settings into the home setting and expand the role of primary care to include public health and to include some of the social protections that are so important for improved health status.
Finally, looking to healthcare corporations themselves, what actions could leaders take to increase transparency in their business practices and support patients?
Well, as you know, transparency is becoming a much overutilized term in American healthcare. For some, it has to do with price transparency. But there's a different kind of transparency that I've kind of learned about by serving on public company boards. And that's the kind of transparency that comes about by explaining to stakeholders and to constituents what actually happens in the boardroom. And so I think it's really important, if we want to change the dialogue about corporatization, for corporate leaders to be transparent about what motivates them, what are their aspirations, what are their values. A lot of that is reflected in how we compensate executive leaders. What are the things that are measured and reported and evaluated in the boardroom? And how is that performance factored into the reward system for compensating the leaders of a corporation? For the boards that I've worked for as a healthcare leader, they would hold management accountable for measures of patient care quality and patient satisfaction and access, employee safety and engagement, and effective and appropriate cost management. And so it isn't just about the bottom line, and it isn't just about a financial motivation, but healthcare boards, at least in my experience, they care about the reliability and the consistency of service delivery. And they care about our interactions with patients. And so it goes well beyond the way corporations are sometimes characterized as being just about the bottom line. And so I would encourage the leaders of these big mega provider organizations to be transparent about what motivates them and what they value and what they aspire to, because I think it would increase the understanding and the appreciation for how these organizations are working to improve the human condition.
Thank you, Mr. Lipstein.